Well, this fellow was not alone. The other fellows. Now, it didn't matter whether they had to cover their cover any longer, okay? Mm. It was a little more out in the open while we were unloading and unloading the trucks, okay? And this got more like, you know, football locker room, okay? Type of, you know, subtle dialogue, you know, with the boxes going back and forth, okay? And we're going up, it's the end of the day, about 4 o'clock, we're going up a back elevator, wooden elevator, you know, creaking up, old elevator with all the boxes you've unloaded it from, or loaded it, you've unloaded it from. So you're squeezed up against this, the wood panels in the wood elevator, and all the boxes are there, and we're going to unload that, and then we go home, okay? Or put that in the warehouse, you know, we've unloaded it from the truck, take it up to the warehouse, and then we have to, you know, shelve it, and then get the hell out of here. So, you know, okay. I'm going up, and they, you see, because I didn't know really what these guys wanted, okay? I think the feeling I got from them was like, look, we sent you the businessmen, the nice guys, you know, what you want to see, like, you know, we got other guys, you know, all right. So,
So did you feel all of your coworkers at that time were keeping an
absolutely.
Eye on you?
Absolutely, absolutely, all mm-hmm. seven of them, mm-hmm. yeah, absolutely. Not only all seven of them, but I felt that the people at the company, okay, that we almost had a choice whether we wanted to work or not, and that they had been that had gone up the chain of command in time inside that firm, and had been told that something like this was going to go on, okay, and. Because the managers were civilians, if I can use that term, but it was obvious, like, you know, I mean, there were times when these guys and I were just talking, like we weren't doing any work. I mean, if it was really a legitimate gig, somebody would have come in over and said, you know, like, hey, you know, you're getting paid, you know, get back to work, mm-hmm. you know. I mean, that's not what happened. We had the run of the place, you know. Yeah. One morning I came in, and this guy, we hadn't started working as yet, and he said, hey, Ron, you ever hear of G. Gordon Liddy? Well, I said, oh, yeah, I think I heard of that dude. You know, that was the guy who busted Leary on acid the first time, right, up in Millbrook. I knew some people who used to hang out with Leary, you know. He said, oh, yeah, G. Gordon, man. You think it's true? Like, you know, and he lit his lighter, right? He said, you think it's true? Like, he put his hand over the flame, you know. And then he shut it on. You know, he was going to show me that he could do it also and burn his flesh, you know. We're riding up in this elevator. You see, I'm avoiding saying this story. Get through this story, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. These two guys in the back. And I didn't know if they were putting me on and just having fun, you know, with the jerk, you know. But one of them says, what do you think of that license to kill shit? You know, and the other one says, oh, I don't use that much. I just sort of went, oh, goody. Right? Yeah, you know, play hardball, right? So, you know, so I went, hey, are we going to unload the boxes or what? You know? So I went, yeah, man, you know, let's unload the fucking box. Yeah. Anyway, I came home. I had really had enough of New York. I got my second week paycheck, a temporary job, got the money. And it was sort of like, you know, well, goody, I think it's time to pack, because I've sort of had it. Okay, now dig this, okay? Because this, again, is an absolute mind blower. Okay. But I was ready to leave, but the phone rings, okay? And I was foolish. I didn't jot down this fellow's name, which I really wasn't sharp, but I was off center. I was nervous. I really was. But he says, this is so-and-so. I'm an editor at the New York Times Sunday Magazine section. I said, oh, are you really? So he said, oh, yes. He said, now, you remember I had been, you know, jesting or whatever the hell, foolishly saying, you know, get a job at New York Times.
Just
right?
The two first
right, setup person, right? So
this was, what, about 2 weeks after that?
Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, I guess they had worked it out. They had cleared it. Uh-huh. right? Okay.
And had you sent your resume to the New York
no,
Times?
No, no. Hold on. So I said, oh, yeah? So I wanted to see how he was going to handle this, you know? So he says, well, you know, we at the New York Times, like, we're very well connected with a lot of different people. I said, I've heard that. So he said, you know, and New York City, you know, we're always looking for very talented people, you know. And, you know, we have some people who work in employment environments and things like that. And I've seen your copy of your resume, right? I said, oh, have you? He said, oh, yeah. And he said, would you like to come in for an interview? I said, hey, man, I wouldn't miss it for the world. Okay? So I want to read a segment of that that covers that. And
this is from your book, Transgressions.
This is from my book, Transgressions, by Ronald Howard Cohen. Okay. I didn't want to feel fear or awe, but I did. I was going to an interview with the New York Times, the paper of record. It was hard not to be impressed. I took the subway up to 42nd Street in Times Square and walked over to 43rd Street. The Times building ran the entire block from 7th to 8th Avenue. There was a workman's style cafe across from the Times, and I decided to sip on a cup of coffee for a few minutes. I still had about a quarter of an hour till my appointment. I'm going to cut more into... I entered the jammed elevator and watched for my floor to light up on an indicator above the floor. I was still nervous. Even in this crowded elevator, the air itself seemed to be thinning out, bringing everything into focus, making details distinct. I was entering some sort of center of power. You'll be all right, I told myself. As soon as you actually meet this guy, you'll be all right. Mr. Berg is just one more human. My floor arrived and I got off the elevator. There was another reception desk right ahead of me with the sign saying, The Sunday Times Magazine, on the wall, behind it. I told the man sitting there that I had an appointment with Mr. Berg, and he lifted the receiver of the phone on his desk and announced me. A Mr. Rosen is here to see you, Mr. Berg. Okay, now, let me cut into this a little. Okay. Now, he comes out and he says, look, why don't we talk up in the cafeteria, okay? And we walk down the hall there to the employees' cafeteria. Almost all of the many tables in the cafeteria were empty. There was a good food serving area off to the side, and Mr. Berg started to walk towards it. Grab a seat at the back table, will you? That one back there looks good. How do you take your coffee? I told him, and I went way down the room to sit at the table he had pointed to. There sure wasn't any chance of our conversation being overheard. I looked at the leaves of a potted plant waving from the effects of the circulating air or air conditioning. My nervousness had disappeared. This was some interview. The man seemed ready to give me the store. I was terribly confused. Okay. Comes back. We chit-chat. I guess you know the Sunday magazines gets one hell of a lot of copy filled with a lot of so-called facts that need some very careful checking. You ever do that sort of work? I always like to check my facts, I smiled at him. Good, he smiled back. A very good policy. He looked down at my resume for a while and then up at me. We both sipped at our coffee. We've got a slot that pays $45,000 a year. My face must have shown how much that figure struck me. I know that the smaller places don't pay that sort of scale, but this is the Times. I don't know how my co-worker will take to taking on someone new right now. I will have to check with her. I looked around the almost deserted cafeteria for a minute, and I sighed deeply. As I looked down the room to a table where a woman and two men sat chatting, they were talking together like comrades. In my soul, I wanted to be sitting there, to be one of them. So, at an out-of-the-way back table, in a nice, clean cafeteria, I came to decision time. I couldn't do it. Damn it all to hell, I couldn't do it. Mr. Berg, can I ask you something? Certainly, what? What's going on here? I mean, I don't have the credentials for this job. Most of my resume is sheer fluff and gun smoke. I'm pretty sure you can see that. He nodded and looked straight at me, feeling, I'm sure, 10 times more uncomfortable than he had been only a few minutes before. Obviously, I was going to turn out to be a real character. Of course, I'm thrilled at having an opportunity like this. In fact, if I have come upon it honestly, I'd be jumping all over the place. But I can't do anything if I don't know what really is going on. I don't know what to say, Mr. Burke replied. I know that about 10 years ago, a Senate committee said that the CIA and some newspapers were involved with each other, but I thought that it all stopped. Mr. Berg didn't like the sound of the word CIA, but he reacted like an editor who spent his life checking facts and sticking to them. Yes, in the 1970s, I believe it was 15 newspapers, a dozen major book publishing companies, and about 400 writers and journalists. If I remember correctly, he grimaced and continued. If I remember correctly, staring at me, he grimaced, some fellows have found it all to be very lucrative. All of that has gone on all the time I've been here, and I've been here for some time. There never seems to be a problem recruiting people. I personally think it's all very dangerous practice. But others say that's the only way to know which whore is trying to take a piss on you. Do you feel that way? I believe in accuracy, he said, and our discussion was over. Okay, it goes on considerable lengths from there, but I did want to get that all.
So how close to that was that to what really happened to
was that? Oh, that was pretty close, Jim. That was pretty close. That now you got to keep in mind what I've now done. Okay.
So right now you've had
I've told them to take a hike, as you say, and then, you know, they offer me $45,000 gig. I'm not going to take a bribe. Okay. Yuck. You know, I'm a real yuck, right? I mean, to their community, I mean, like, you know, they're being nice.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they just told me that there's no freedom of the press. You know, and my book isn't going to get published, but they're going to get me a job at the New York Times. What? I clear it. I get in touch with my agent, who never was able to sell the book, and we finally parted company. She gave up. I told my agent I'm going back to Canada, okay, and I'm going to get relocated there, and we'll stay in touch by phone and mail, okay? So I went back to Canada, and I got the same feeling I always get when I cross the border. Oh, thank God. You know, for whatever you got going here, you know, I mean, at least, you know, it's some degree rational. Anyway, so I came back, took a whole process, you know, where I got an apartment, okay, got some furniture, but I still had other stuff. I had all my stuff stored.
Moved to Toronto at this point?
Moved back to Toronto. The thing is, like, you know, I'm now ready to go back to Brattleboro, Vermont, okay?
Where you still have all of your
all of my stuff stored. Okay. Now I hire a moving man.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. To drive down to Brattleboro, Vermont.
Right.
Okay. Load up all of my possessions, including my life's work, all of my writing. Okay. And go back to Toronto with him. Okay. Very nice moving guy. He and his girlfriend. We drove down in his van, you know, and I said, you know, like, that's fine, you know, pay the mileage, you know, and, you know, like, I don't think we'll have to stay over, but if we do, you know, etc. Okay. Went down there. We had lunch in Brattleboro. Very nice town, by the way. It's sort of a wine and cheese cracker place for ski lodges and people who are academics in Harvard and MIT, aside from being just Vermont. Anyway, which is very pretty in the autumn, but we had lunch, and where this was stored was Hillwind's farm, okay, which was a farm with a very big barn, okay, big barn that had been converted into a storage facility, okay,
storage lockers,
storage lockers, mm-hmm. Okay, So we drive out to Hillwinds Farm, okay? So we bring the truck in through the you know, the front where the horses came in, and now, you know, the truck pulls in. Mm-hmm. And it's like paddocks, but they're now storage facilities rather than paddocks, right? And I go to open my lock. Now, there's a caretaker. This is like out in the boonies, okay? But there's a caretaker who lives on the premises, okay? And every month I had paid the rent there and even was in correspondence with them, you know, and to some degree, you know, they were nice people, you know? And I went to open my lock. That's not my lock. On the clasp. So I said, "Wait here," to the driver and his girlfriend, and I said, "I got to find out what's happening here." Okay. So I went over to the caretaker's facility. And I said, "What's with the lock?" She said, "Well, Mr. Cohen, I didn't understand." She said, "You're a very responsible guy, but you must have, you know, like, forgot to put your lock on. Well, you know, you came down here, you know, before you went back to Canada, you came down back here and took some stuff. You must have forgotten to put your lock on. Because I went, you know, I keep the place very secure, and I went walking through there, and I noticed you didn't have a lock on your locker." And she said, "You know, so I put a lock on." I said, "Oh, really?" She said, "Yeah, I'll open it for you." So she opened the locker for me. Now, my first impression was it's all there.
And you were you sure at that point that you had put the lock on?
Oh, yeah. Because I'm a total paranoid about those type of things. Right. What I do when I lock something, I pull on it. Okay? I pull on it and I pull on it, you know, until I have to tell myself, "Ronnie, you're going to stop. It's locked." Okay? Okay? So I know. You know, it's just anyone who knows me knows it's not the type of thing I do. Mm-hmm. I'm anally retentive or something to the degree of that type of stuff. Mm-hmm. Okay?
So you opened your locker. You saw all your stuff there.
So it seemed like a full, you know, storage space filled with stuff. I don't know. Maybe it's kids. What the hell do I know? So I look around, and my hi-fi, you know, my record stuff is there, and I see books are there, and, you know, and I don't know. Let's load the truck up. Okay? So I said, "Well, thank you very much." You know, she takes off, and we load the truck up. Okay. The truck's loaded, and something's like, but I'm not quite sure what, okay? So we get in the truck, and I say, "We got to stop in town." He said, "Why?" I said, "I want to stop at the police station." Okay? Said, "Okay, you pay him." We stop at the police station. I go in. I say to the guy at the desk, I say, "Look, I wanted you to take this all down. This is official business, okay?" Told him who I was. I have a little card that says writer, okay? Ronald Hal Cohen, writer, okay? I said, "Look," had told him the whole story. I said, because this is what was in my mind, and I wanted to cover my backside this way. Mm-hmm. I said, "Look, I don't have any drugs. You understand me? I am not a drug dealer, okay? If I get stopped at the border, and they go through my stuff, and find drugs, I want you to know that I reported this, and I didn't have them, they were planted there, okay? That, you know," and I said, "Look, there's a whole long story about it. I may just be off the wall right now. It won't be necessary. I hope it's not necessary. So there's no reason for me going into the whole long story." And he's a rural cop. We get on the highway. And then shivers through me. I went, "Oh no." I said, "Stop the truck." What I had remembered, okay, we had lifted, okay, first of all, it registered just at the same minute I had more boxes. My writing was in some boxes. Those boxes weren't there, okay? But more what struck me was I had a lot of writing in these two trunks, okay? And, I mean, that was all of my work, from stuff that I had my original first story that I did when I was 8 years old, okay? I mean, I had poetry readings on tapes that I had given in New York, you know? Not only that, but I had my commercial portfolio, you know, as an advertising copywriter. I had all this stuff, right? And my clippings and blah, 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 you know? All of my manuscripts for my unpublished novels and short stories and poems and plays and essays and on. So, you know...
Your life's work.
Yeah. When we had loaded the trunks, okay, when those were heavy trunks, okay, they had a lot of stuff in them. It was a two-man job that you had to lift the trunk onto the truck to get... Okay. When we had loaded those trunks, it was like, oh, throw that on the trunk. Throw it on the trunk. How could I have thrown my trunk on the truck? Impossible. Mm-hmm. So I said, stop the truck. He stopped the truck, and I went into the back of the truck, okay? And I opened up both, you know, took stuff out, opened up both trunks, empty. And then I realized I have a computer, but I also had a number of portable typewriters. I was a typewriter nut, and I had a typewriter, a Royal from 1920s that worked, okay? And that was gone too, okay? Message, you know? I just sat there. And the couple came around, and I was crying, right? And they said, what? And I just said, no, nothing. You know, I mean, I couldn't tell them the whole story, man. I mean, they would have said, like, you know, what have we gotten into here, you know? So I said, look, let's just load the truck up, and we'll go back to Toronto, okay? So we drove back to Toronto, and they were very sophisticated, nice people. They didn't ask any questions. We got back to Toronto, and I unpacked, and I was devastated. I mean, I just sort of felt like, oh, this gets into a very bad emotional turn. Boy. I was really pissed. What do you do after your life work is stolen? All right? Well, I got the answer. You're right about it. Okay? So, I sat down. I said, page one, transgression. And we're going to start back 30 years ago. And now we got two incidents to write about. Okay? So the book in manuscript size doubled in size. Okay? But I've rewritten it. It's rewritten. It's gone out to agencies that I've had, to publishers that I've had feedback on. We're
talking major league publishing houses,
and we're talking about senior fiction editors, okay? We're talking about top of the heap, Jim, okay? Who have said to me over the phone, one editor said, Ron, I've worked here a hell of a long time, okay? You made the cut. You made the decision table, okay? We had a cut for, okay? We were only going to publish, you know, X number of books, okay? So, I've seen, like, long fights, okay, over, like, which ones we were going to go with, okay? She said, we didn't go with this. She said, keep at it. Try and get it published, you know? She sounded like she was a little disgusted that she had thought that... I mean, you got to understand, you're dealing with heavyweight dudes, right? That it's a type of publishing house decision that, as far as I can make out, you know, it doesn't, you know, it's like the editor talks to the publisher and goes for a 2-hour lunch and says, okay, do you want to publish this thing? And we go lawyers, and we go, you know, we go, like, you know, lots of money and lots of fights, you know, or what? Yeah. I've asked myself quite intensely, saying, like, look, what is this crap? First of all, is this thing any good? And I've reread it cold. I said, yes, good work. Okay. Okay. So then what gives? What am I mean, this thing could make somebody some bucks, and there are high-risk rollers there. Anyway, after Clinton got in, I mean, I got on the computer. You know, I got the new lineup card, you know, in Washington, D.C., you know, and I started sending out letters, you know. I mean, like, to all, hello, welcome aboard, you know. Hello, this is stuff that hasn't been looked at under the Nixon administration and the Reagan administration. Eventually, what happened with that was the U.S. Senate Oversight Committee, whose vice chair is Senator Bob Kerry from Nebraska, he wrote me back. And basically, I mean, I'm not quoting word for word, he basically said, you know, all right, man, you know, you straight shooter, what you got? I'll have somebody check it out. Okay.
This is under Clinton now.
Under Clinton. Under Clinton. Okay.
Had you been in contact with Bob Kerry before?
No. Uh-huh. No. He was a new cast. If you've ever been in a senator's office, and I have, they got lots of files and papers and lots of different stuff, right? So he has a staff person, okay? And that's really who you work with. So there was a gentleman who was on the committee, Senate Oversight Intelligence Committee, which is the committee that's supposed to be the oversight committee for the intelligence community, okay? They're the ones who supposedly, you know, in the back room or in camera, supposedly they say, what's going on? And supposedly they're supposed to be told what's going on, all right? So he was, you know, like, I don't know, in his 30s, okay? So he did a lot of, he said, look, I'm really busy. He said, like, you know, I've taken this on my plate. It's a little heavy for me to be doing, but okay, you know, I got to do what I got to do. Yeah. So, but as he said, you know, because he would call me on the phone, he said, hey, man, I'm open. He said, as far as I know, from what I found out, anything is possible. Okay? So, I mean, that's from the horse in the stable, okay? That's from talking down at the barn, okay? And at some point, there was some headway, it seemed to me, you know, since I had been sandbagged, as the saying goes, where you don't get any information, you know, mm-hmm. For so long.
At least you got some positive feedback.
It seemed,
from that
well, I didn't,
committee.
Yeah, people didn't call me on the phone to call me Ron. I mean, you know, we had more aristocratic, well, Mr. Curran, we'll more look into that for you, without a doubt. And we'll be back in touch. you know, so like, I felt there was some movement, okay? But then I got a letter back most recently, okay? Well, relatively recently. That was much more formal from this fellow at the Senate Oversight Committee, and it was basically a turndown. I got on the phone with him, and I said, hey, what shakes? You know, and it was much more formal response. What I had, okay, as per documentation, okay, I had the company names of all the setup situations. I had the dates. I went home and I scribbled, okay? I had the dates. I had the names of these people who they identified themselves as. This guy said he's from the CIA. This guy said he's from the FBI. He met me on such and such a date at such and such a time, okay? Okay. I had all of that, okay, which is pretty good, something to look into about, mm-hmm. Okay? So, I had sent that to his researcher on the subcommittee, and Kerry writes me back, and he says, you know, well, if you have something, you know, but right now there's nothing, right? So I wrote him back a letter, and I said, dear Robert, you know, man to man, since I'm an asshole enough, you know, to maybe even go back to New York or Washington or whatever the hell it is, you know, what exactly would you like me to bring you on your desk? You know, so he hasn't written back to that. Maybe it was Dear Robert, I don't know.
We have been listening to an interview with Ronald Howard Cohen, a survivor of abduction and drugging by the CIA and U.S. military, and his subsequent harassment by agencies of the U.S. government and interfering in his efforts to publish a book about his ordeal. Please excuse the strong language that was used in the show, but I felt it was important to include what Ronald's account of what was actually said in his interactions with the U.S. government agents. This has been part 8 of a series about mind control on the International Connection here on CKLN. Next week, we are featuring a panel discussion entitled An Overview of Ritual Abuse, Mind Control, and Dissociation with Walter Boert, Alan Shefflin, and Randy Noblett.